third edition, I finally got some maps that I really like, and the second to the last one has Paul's extradition trip to Rome. And so it kind of shows you, you know, if you're a sight learner like myself, I'm a sight learner more than anything, and it kind of shows you where he's heading. So it's kind of neat to follow that. Acts 27, and let's go ahead and pray. Lord, I do ask you to help us to understand your words. I do pray that you'd help us to know what we can apply to ourselves. Help us to see the storyline, what's going on, and maybe possibly get something that might encourage us in our faith or something that might challenge us in our faith. Help us to be faithful to these words. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, Acts 27. The legal term is an extradition, okay, where he's going from one place to another under the, under the control of guards or whatnot. And so Paul is being transferred from Israel over to Rome. And so Acts 27 is recording the trip. Some of it's just plain narrative. And then chapter 28 is after the shipwreck that they experienced. So we'll get some things out of it. Verse 1, and it says, "When it was determined that we should sail into Italy, they delivered Paul and certain other prisoners unto one named Julius, a centurion of Augustus, of Augustus' band." So a centurion, he had 100 soldiers underneath him. So he was the one in charge of Paul and going from place to place, from this place. And he's also in charge of another fella that was with Paul, possibly as a prisoner, possibly facing a court problem also. Verse 2, entering into a ship of whatever that name is, we launched, meaning to sail by the coast of Asia. Okay, the coast of Asia in the Bible, that's what we commonly call Asia Minor. Okay, and so he is giving the intended voyage, what they're planning on doing, what the captain was planning on doing. And then notice the next fella, and Aristarchus, a Macedonian of Thessalonica, being with us. Now, I don't know if this guy's facing trial also. If you would, go back to Acts 19:29, and we see this gentleman. And we see that this fellow was kind of thrown in the middle of a fight. But it didn't. A lot of people that get thrown in the middle of a fight as a new believer, man, they said, "I didn't know that this was a part of it." And then they take off and never want to see them again. But in Acts 19:29, the whole city was filled with confusion, and having caught Gaius and Aristarchus, men of Macedonia, Paul's companions in travel. So these guys, ding, supper's ready. Okay, and so these guys are with Paul. This Gaius is mentioned in Galatians, I think it is, or 1 Corinthians. And this Aristarchus is also mentioned in Colossians chapter 4, verse 10. So these men were men that understood the struggles that Paul went through and the persecutions. And praise the Lord, they didn't run away from Paul. They stuck with him through his tough times. Colossians 4, verse 10. Aristarchus, my fellow prisoner, saluteth you. So it does appear that he was on the same extradition trip as Paul, unless he just voluntarily stayed with Paul. And then there's other fellows mentioned there. So you'll see that Paul's not alone in this matter. The party that's never mentioned is the writer of Luke, of the book of the Acts, is the Apostle Luke, or the writer Luke. Verse 2, the next day we touched at Sidon, touched as in like an airplane you touch down, or they just came in and then went out. And Julius courteously entreated Paul and gave him liberty to go unto his friends to refresh himself. So Julius was like a prison guard. or a soldier guarding somebody, and he treated his prisoners, in this case, politely. Now, that's a rare thing. It's a rare thing. I mentioned, I think it was just last week, about the Stanford study, Stanford University, where students were the prison guards and students were the prisoners. They planned a two-week study. It was such a psychological damage that they stopped after 5 days. Okay, and often the prison guards. I remember going down to prison down there in Danville, and you see the prisoners behind bars, but then you see a woman when you're walking in, and there's the guard, a couple guards, they're behind glass thing, and I'm sitting there thinking, well, they're in prison just like those guys are in prison. It's just that there's the last 8 hours, and they go home, and then they come back. But, you know, the tendency is that these prisoners are the scum of the earth, so they start treating them like it. But Julius evidently wasn't a man like that, or God had brought Paul into his favor, where Paul was kind to this man, wasn't demanding. We'll find a couple other people like that in the Bible. In Daniel 1, verse 9, remember that Daniel, it says that God brought Daniel into tender favor of Melzar. And so Melzar was kind to Daniel. And then in Esther chapter 2, verse 9, when the king wanted to check out all these new maidens and basically all these young girls that came into the king's kingdom who were prospects for the new queen, they would get clothes and they'd get to keep the clothes and take them back. And no doubt, hey man, this is we're going to get us all we can get. And yeah, if you can imagine the arguing and the fighting and the jockeying for position. But it says that Esther, again, was brought in favor of the man that was deciding who's going to be where. And he upped her date because evidently she was polite and kind to him. Okay, and so it's like, okay, if you're in a bad situation and a person over you really don't like the situation, you don't like the situation, well, don't make their life miserable. I mean, you just try to make the best of it. And so you got those three people, the Bible records that they, all three of them, were under subject, under someone, and they evidently had a kindness about them or a cooperative spirit about them that these people treated them with courtesy. Now, that's not a guarantee. Some people are just jerks no matter how kind you are to them. But in Paul's case, so this guy, Julius, courteously entreated Paul, so he probably made an agreement with Paul and said, hey, if you take off, run away, you know, it's on my head, and I'm going to trust you. So they evidently had agreement, and he could trust him. Okay, so verse 4, and when we had launched from thence, we sailed under Cyprus, under south of it. Cyprus, an island in the Mediterranean. So you can kind of see the path that they were traveling. Okay, or no, Cyprus was, it was between Cyprus and Asia Minor. Okay, and then it says the winds were contrary. So as a sailboat goes, the winds were contrary. They were wanting to go this way, but the winds are going against them. And this is a phrase where the Bible calls free course in 2 Thessalonians, where the wind is favorably pushing you to your direction. In this case, the winds were contrary to them. Verse 5, and when he had sailed over the sea of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra, a city of Lycia. Now, these are just names the Bible records. They may or may not be there today. But verse 6 is, I think, just an interesting statement. And there the centurion found a ship of Alexandria sailing into Italy, and he put us therein. Now, I can see the context. It's quite obvious that this ship was from Alexandria, Egypt, and it's going to Italy. But coincidentally, the manuscripts of the New Bibles are Alexandrian manuscripts, and they go to Italy. It's the same thing. This is the fourth and final time Alexandria is found in the Bible, and it's a ship that goes to Italy. Now, obviously, we can't be dogmatic on something like this. We can see the context, because you can see that someone's going to jump all over it. Oh, he says that this is so. But it is a coincidence, maybe it's not a coincidence by God, that the manuscripts of Vaticanus Sinaiticus manuscripts or Alexandrian manuscripts from Alexandria, Egypt, and they're the ones that are in contrary to the Syrian manuscript, the Antiochian manuscripts of the King James Bible, and yet this one says that this ship is going to Italy. And that's where the manuscripts go. They go to the Vatican. So, yes, it's just a ship. No, it's not saying that's how the Bibles work, but it happened to be that's what the Bibles have done, the translations have done in Acts 27, verse 6. So, verse 7, he mentions more where they're sailing, coming along. Drop down to verse 9. Now, when much time was spent, when sailing was now dangerous, because the fast was now already past, Paul admonished them and said unto them, Sirs, I perceive that this voyage will be with hurt and much damage, not only of the lading and ship, but also of our lives. Okay, you can understand why these guys would not take his advice. Who are you? Well, I'm an apostle. Oh, yeah, and you're going to tell us how to operate a ship? Well, I've been on several voyages. I kind of know something about it, and it's just my perception. I perceive that this is what's going to happen. So he's evidently at liberty to influence the people making the decisions. So he throws out his opinion or his thought or his viewpoint, and they don't take it. Okay, that's how it goes. He just threw it out there. Verse 11, it says, Nevertheless, the centurion believed the master and the owner of the ship. Now, the master and the owner of the ship has a right to decide, hey, this thing is sailing. Paul said, hey, I think you're going to lose it. And the centurion said, well, I'm going to believe the owner. I'm going to believe the master. We're getting on ship. Okay, and when they lost it, notice, if you would, that Paul does say, if you would have listened about verse 21, Paul says there, and after a long abstinence of verse 21, Paul stood forth in the midst of them and said, Sirs, you should have hearkened unto me. Okay, and of course, now, I told you so. Okay, but, you know, he's just telling, but yet now he's giving them comfort of verse 22. Okay, if we back up, we can see certain things. Okay, verse 12, and because the haven was not commodious to winter in. Again, from our perspective, this is kind of hard to figure. What's he talking about? In those days, when they were sailing these ships, they had to find a port where they could park for how long are they going to winter there? 3 months? What do those guys do for 3 months? 2 to 3 months or whatever, how long they're stuck there. They're stuck there. They don't have a television to watch. They don't have, you know, games to play on their phone. They got to survive somehow. Boy, I like hearing that thunder this time of year. And so they were looking for a place to park it, to dock or whatever, some marina if they have those and everything. And so that's what they're trying to figure out, but they're wanting to keep going. Verse 13, verse 14, there's a tempestuous wind that's named. Okay, so this is a pattern of naming hurricanes. It used to be they were all named after women, hurricane. But a few years back, part of this political correctness, they now started naming after men, so I guess we have to call them hurricanes. Okay, but it used to be only females because of hurricane. So the pattern of naming a storm comes from the Bible. That's the standard. Verse 15, and when the ship was caught and could not bear up into the wind, we let her drive. Okay, Jeremy, correct me if I'm wrong on that. You just let the sails go and let the thing go. Don't know on that one? Okay. That's a sailing we did in the little lake in Wisconsin. I think that's what they're doing. They're just letting the sails, or pulling them out, pulling them down, whatever, and just let the thing go where it's going. Okay, let her drive. Verse 16, and running under a certain island which is called Clauda, we had much work to come by the boat, which when they had taken up, they used helps, undergirding the ship, fearing that lest they should fall into the quicksand, strake sail, and so were driven. And we being exceedingly tossed with a tempest, the next day they lightened the ship, so now they're throwing stuff over. In the old days, when the pioneers would take their covered wagons, and they'd come through this area trying to get out west, they didn't have a hard time finding their way because furniture was usually thrown over the side. As they're going, they're lightening. Well, we don't need that. We don't need that. We got to get through these mounts of this snow. We don't need that. And so a lot of this stuff was just thrown overside to lighten it. They're doing the same here. They're throwing stuff on the side, lightening it, lightening the ship. 19, and the third day we cast out with our own hands the tackling of the ship. Tackling is a King James only word. I don't think they use that word anymore, right? Tackle box or anything like that. King James only word. Third day, they're not sleeping. I don't think they're sleeping through this time. I don't care how many they got on that boat. Has anybody been out east to see a replica of the Mayflower? Has anybody ever done that? Okay, you have. Okay, Kim. It wasn't that amazing how small that boat was. I was just, we took a trip out around Boston, Plymouth, that rock area, and they have a Mayflower replica. And the top deck is only sailors, and then all the pilgrims was on the second deck. I mean, no windows per se, everything's boarded up. No showers, no bathroom, seasickness, smell, and the third floor was the furniture, or the third deck down. And it was a very small room. And that's why a lot of them died. And it's just kind of hard. How long were they in there? 60-some days, I think, they were in there. But can you imagine the smell of the bodies and the barfing and everything that the pilgrims went through? And no wonder when they got here, they thanked God to get out of that mess. But if you're ever over there in that area, it is well worth the trip. Did you go to the Plymouth Plantation where they act out as William Bradford and all that? That was fun too. You know, trying to get them off base because they're only supposed to know up till 1620. And so you try to tell them about the Cubs and what's that, you know, and you try to tell them about this and that. And I was talking to one of them about the new translation that came out, which would have been the 1611. Because if they're in 1620, 1625, 1630, I mentioned the new translation to one of them, and he said, "Oh, you know anything about that?" I said, "Yeah, I know a little bit about that." And he didn't like the idea of that house. He didn't think it was a good idea to have that new translation. Then I went to another house, and I brought it up with him over there, the actor. And he said, "Oh, that's a very good translation." I said, "You are right. That is a very good translation." And they had old Bibles to show them the Bible that they had in those days. So it's really a fun thing to do. And you learn a lot of things out of that. Okay, but in this case, 3 days, 72 hours, if they got any sleep, it's amazing, trying to survive that. Verse 20, and when neither sun nor stars in many days appeared, and no small tempest lay on us, all hope that we should be saved was then taken away. So you got 276 people on this boat, ship, and somehow Paul became a leader, per se, or they would at least listen to his advice. So verse 21, and after a long abstinence, Paul stood forth in the midst of them and said, "Sirs, you should have hearkened unto me." Okay, yeah, we should have. "And not have loosed from Crete." Okay, yeah, you're right. "And to have gained this harm and loss. And now I exhort." Okay, so he's going to encourage them. Even though they made a mistake, okay, even though they're going to suffer the loss here, Paul is still going to try to encourage them, and he says, "And now I exhort you, be of good cheer." That's after verse 20 where they said all hope is lost. Sometimes words, not sometimes, but words that are expressed from our mouth can be a great encouragement or discouragement to somebody, depending upon the influence a spirit or the spirit puts on our words, where death and life are in the power of the tongue. So, be of good cheer. For there shall be no loss of any man's life among you, but of the ship. Now, what proof does he got for that? He's got no proof of that. So, at that point, I bet the guys were thinking, well, let's hope so. Or I don't believe it, because some of them didn't believe it. And their actions showed they didn't believe it. But then Paul gives a verification of why he says this. For there stood by me this night the angel of God, whose I am and whom I serve. So the angel of God in this context would probably be the Lord Jesus Christ. So he probably showed up. Okay, secretly. I don't know if Luke saw him. And I don't know if Aristarchus saw him, the guy in verse 2. But the Lord showed up. Okay, and he is telling Paul what's going to happen. And then Paul is telling the people what's going to happen. He said, saying, "Fear not, Paul, thou must be brought before Caesar. And lo, God hath given thee all them that sail with thee." So God influenced the heart of the people to listen to Paul. You see, that's a part of a ministry per se that God has, where God will call a man to a service. But if he wants a ministry established, he will call people to cooperate with that man to have a ministry develop, be it church, be it whatever it is. It's not just him by himself. It's people that come along with him and are in agreement with the word. That is the second aspect of it. Okay, and so in verse 24, God hath given thee all them that sail with thee. God moved the hearts of these sailors to listen to Paul. And so that's a prayer that we can pray. We can pray that, how about this prayer? Ash was out in New York, and one of the speakers, I don't think it was a pastor, just maybe it was a Sunday school class, just challenged the people this challenge. He said, how about everybody pray that God would give them somebody they can witness to this week? Okay, so if it's Thursday until next week. So Ash prayed. She said, would you give me something, someone that I could witness to this week? And at the school where she's taken her classes, a kid started bombing her with questions, and she's got answering all the questions, got to witness to him. She said, man, that's a blessing. But you see, that was God moving that person to her to listen. Okay, and so that would be what we could call a divine appointment, where God opened up the door, okay, and God is the one that arranged it. And so, in this case, the sailors are listening to Paul. Then verse 25, he says this, "Wherefore, sirs, be of good cheer. For I believe God that it shall be even as it was told me." Now, we could say that about any verse in the Bible. Okay, as far as, let's say Psalms 12, verse 6. "The words of the Lord are pure words, as silver tried in a furnace of earth. Thou shalt preserve them, O Lord, from this generation forever." Okay, on that verse, I believe God even as it was told me. And you could just take this verse as a text verse and just throw a bunch of message in there. Okay? Take this verse, say, "Well, I believe God that it shall be even as it was told me." I'm not going to add to it. I'm not going to subtract from it. I'm not going to change it. And Paul is making this statement to a brief time of a calm or somehow of people who've been wide, been awake for 3, 4, 5 days trying to endure this storm, and the plane's going down, or the boat's going down, the ship's going down, and he's trying to encourage them, And he says, hey, we're going to make it through, just like I was told. I believe God. Now, he didn't say, I believe in God. I believe him. I believe God. You know, how many people will take verses out of the Bible, change them, and in essence calling God a liar? You know, how about God in heaven say, wow, you believe me? Oh, that's great. When God told Abraham when he was about 75, he's going to have a boy, he said, okay, I believe you. And then God honored him for his belief. I mean, the chance of a 75-year-old guy, 65-year-old wife, you know, and then another 10 years go by and still nothing's happening as far as that promise goes. God rewarded Abraham for believing something when you shouldn't be believing it. He's making the statement, I believe God, when it looks like all is lost. And so it's a matter of faith in the Lord. Verse 26, he says, howbeit we must cast upon a certain island. Okay, and when the 14th night was come, 2 weeks, sleep, that's one of the ways to drive a person crazy. Sleep deprivation, is that what they call it? Keep them awake all the time. I mean, you can't get hardly any sleep. 14 days of this? no doubt they're going goofy. Okay, when the 14th night was come, as we were driven up and down Adria, about midnight, the shipmen deemed that they were drew near to some country and sounded and found it 20 fathoms. And when they had gone a little further, they sounded again and found it 15 fathoms. Then fearing lest we should have fallen upon rocks, they cast 4 anchors out of the stern and wished for the day. And the shipmen were about to flee out of the ship. When they had let down the boat into the sea, under color, as though they would have cast anchors out of the foreship. Now, when you read that, you say, wow, that's strange. Under color. Any of us that have taken that law class knows what that under color means. Color of title, color of authority, color of law, colored people. Colored people wasn't referring to the color of their skin. Colored people or color of law is a semblance of law, but it's a false pretense. It's a pretended law. An NIV is a color of Bible, is what it's a fake Bible. And this is the only time this term is found in the Bible. Under color is when somebody's appearing to do something that they're not supposed to be doing. And that's really how most public officials work today. It's under color. Okay? We get a bill of sale from a car that we buy or something. We take that to the BMV and they give us a title. Right? They don't give us a title. They give us a certificate of title. That's not a title. Title of ownership is your bill of sale. But that was given to the state who converted your conveyance into a motor vehicle. All these terms. But this is where these things come from. It is a color of title. It's not a real title, it's a color of title. I forget what the title of origin. Is that the original one? Title of origin? From the manufacturer. Yeah, if you go to a dealership and buy brand spanking new, you can get from the manufacturer, not a certificate of title, a title of origin, which is the highest ownership. It places it above anything, and technically you don't need a license plate and insurance, all that stuff, but you are going to fight on that one. We know some folks that tried that. Okay, but again, you're fighting it. To be honest with you, it's not worth the fight. Getting from point A to point B. Okay, but here we have tucked away in an extradition trip a term. The Bible is a fascinating book. Okay, just tucked right in there. Okay, in verse 31, Paul saw this was taking place, and he said to the centurion, to the soldiers, except these abide in a ship, you cannot be saved. Everybody's got to stay. Then the soldiers cut off the ropes of the boat and let her fall off. And I'll bet you that was an empty feeling. You know, and so by this time, evidently they had, okay, Paul, we're going to do what Paul says. God had moved their hearts to listen what he says. 33, and while day was coming on, Paul besought them to take meat. Hurry up and eat, fellas. You got to eat something. You got to get your strength. This day is the 14th day that ye have tarried and continued fasting, having taken nothing. That is a fast. No sleeping or very little sleep. No, very little food. The water they're getting is what's spraying in their face. Okay, so these guys are dead worn out. So 34, he encouraged them to eat something. Wherefore I pray you to take some meat, for this is for your health. For there shall not an hair fall from the head of you, of any of you. So we could say they're all bald headed. I don't know. Just a saying, obviously. And when he had thus spoken, he took bread and gave thanks to God in the presence of them all. And when he had broken it, he began to eat. So they prayed. Then were they all of good cheer. Hey, everybody's excited. And they all took some meat. And we were all in a ship, 276 souls, 276. And when they had eaten enough, they lightened the ship and cast out the wheat into the sea. So they took all their YK2 supply and threw it out. Threw everything out. Okay, and when it was day, they knew the land, but they discovered a certain creek with a shore into the which they were minded, if it were possible, to thrust in a ship. And when they had taken up the anchors, they committed themselves unto the sea and loosed the rudder bands and hoisted up the mainsail to the wind and made toward a shore. They're trying to hit a non-rocky area. And falling into a place where two seas met, they ran the ship aground, and the forepart stuck fast and remained unmovable, but the hinder part was broken with the violence of the waves. And a soldier's counsel was to kill the prisoners. Okay, they're all bound, lest any of them should swim out and escape, and a centurion willing to save Paul kept them from their purpose and commanded that they which could swim should cast themselves first into the sea and get to land, and the rest some on boards and some on broken pieces of the ship, and so it came to pass that they escaped all safe to the land. Now when they get on shore and they count everybody, and it comes to 276, they probably looked at Paul. How'd you know that? And he just started a ministry. Right on an island. You talk about a ministry starting with your feet running. I mean, boom, just like that. And sometimes the Lord will take those tragic things, okay, and turn them around, and that's when he gets the glory. Okay, so that's Acts 27. Any questions or comments?